We have told you lots and lots of stories over the past couple of years about courageous whistleblowers from around the world. Almost all of their stories have been personally difficult, but rewarding in the greater scheme of life, because it's always better to tell the truth and because whistleblowing is one of the highest forms of public service. One thing we haven't talked a lot about, though, is the aftermath of whistleblowing, not just for the whistleblower, but for the movement. These individual cases don't just end when they're settled. Oftentimes, whistleblowers go on to found new organizations, to influence policy, and to educate the public. Today, we're going to talk about one of those success stories. I'm John Kiriakou. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. Our next guest is a prominent whistleblower in his own right, having exposed extrajudicial killings, human rights violations, and apartheid-style interrogation techniques being carried out by the South African police. Like every whistleblower I've ever met, Ari Denikas did not start out to be one. He was a Greek teenager who moved to South Africa to live with a family member and to start a career. He had a knack for technology, and he came to the attention of a senior officer in the South African police who encouraged him to become a member of the police auxiliary, working in assisting specialized units with his knowledge in technology. It was a good fit, and Ari began accompanying the police on operations, including operations to arrest burglars and even violent criminals. He often risked his life combating crime in South Africa, and he received numerous police awards for his successes. But it was during those operations that he witnessed something terrible. He witnessed South African police officers, most of them racists, coming out of the old apartheid regime, engaging in torture and even murder. And so he blew the whistle, internally at first. When the word came out, Ari's life and the life of his wife came under threat. Although he tried for 4 years to deal with the crisis while running his electronics business and still fighting crime, he was forced to return to Greece with his wife in 2008, fearing for their lives. Later, Ari gave sworn testimony about these crimes in Greece and immediately came under attack from South Africa's pro-police, white-dominated press. He was defamed and threatened, but that didn't stop him. It encouraged him. So rather than go silent, try to fade into the background, Ari decided to embrace the whistleblower narrative. He began working pro bono with the highly respected Blueprint for Free Speech and with Transparency International Greece, which in 2016 awarded him a special recognition for his whistleblowing efforts. As he gained vast experience advocating for freedom of expression, freedom of speech, and whistleblower protection mechanisms, he created alliances with other European and American whistleblower organizations. They recognized his contributions to the cause. And now he's working on legislation that Greece and other countries can enact to further strengthen whistleblower protections through his own NGO. It's called Liberty of Speech. The bottom line is this: whistleblowing is great, but we need even more whistleblowers like Ari Denikas. Ari joins us today. He is the founder of the Greek NGO Liberty of Speech. Ari, welcome back to the show.
Hi, John. Thank you for having me.
Ari, for those of our viewers who don't know you and don't know your background, could you talk a little bit about your own whistleblowing experience? I know that I didn't do it justice in the opening. You and I have been friends for a long time. I know the details. I've even seen the awful videos that you brought out to expose these crimes. But tell our viewers who you are and why you are doing the work that you're doing. What was it that led you to this point?
Indeed, you and I go back a long way, and we share common Greek inheritance and the passion to speak truth to power. For those who don't know me, I'm a Greek South African, and as a teen, I immigrated to South Africa in order to study electronics, and in the process, I fell in love with the country, its diverse culture, and the rainbow colors of its ethnicity. South Africa offered me opportunities that back in Greece I could never had, and I grabbed those opportunities to successfully build a career in electronics. As a late teen, I lived through the end of apartheid and witnessed South Africa's transposition to a democracy with all its challenges presented. After I became a South African citizen and my computer and electronic business were thriving, I was invited by a senior police officer of a specialized unit to join the reserve force as a volunteer crime scene investigator. innocent as I was in my late 20s and passionate about playing the role of Sherlock Holmes in the IT department, I jumped in the idea of having the training, a badge, and a position within the elite police unit named Serious and Violent Crime at the time. Little that I knew that the head of this unit, together with most of the specialized officers, were ex-apartheid career policemen with a dark past, still nostalgic to the old regime and with a secret code of hatred against people of color. As I spent some time within the unit, I discovered that those racist clusters within the police force were using the protection of the uniform to demonstrate the hatred on African suspects, as well as innocent civilians of color, while promoting prohibited apartheid methods of interrogation, such as torture, extrajudicial killings, and often manipulating and tampering with crime scenes in order to get away with the crimes. When I witnessed my first on-duty torture of a suspect by the Kato Mane unit, I managed to use a state-of-the-art at the time smartphone to obtain three short video clips while I pretended that I was receiving a call from my parents in Greece. At the time, I took a big risk without knowing the word whistleblower. I followed common sense and made an internal disclosure to my commanding officer and supposedly close friend at the time, the director of organized crime unit in KwaZulu-Natal, Durban. He just laughed sarcastically, and when I presented the videos to him, he commented proudly, "That's how my boys get results." He then asked for a copy and a printout of a photo while instructing me to delete the footage. Things started to go south after that. Although I still felt relatively protected by my friendship, or so-called, with this commander of the unit and his family. In 2007, I witnessed what I considered to be the turning point for me when I rushed to a crime scene with the director of the unit and witnessed atrocities and gross human rights violation by the same Kato Mane unit. The director was called by his unit members to the rescue in order to coordinate the tampering of the crime scene and discuss the excessive force used by the policemen, as well as execution of suspects by the unit. I was ordered to pick up spent high-caliber cartridges and hand them over to officers at the scene. I was asked to take photos and videos of the scene. A civilian friend was invited to come with us to the crime scene, and he witnessed the above. A wounded African suspect remained without medical treatment, purposely, and bled to death while the paramedics were refused entry by declaring the scene unsafe, a standard method used by the unit in order for the suspects to die. Within a few months of the incident, and after I had confronted the commanding officer about it, my home was burgled, and there was a drive-by shooting at my store, while I was often received death threats and physical attacks. I made two further external disclosures of corruption via media, announcing my resignation, and after I was harassed by members of my unit at my home, I was forced into exile with my wife.
You returned to Greece a decade or so ago with corrupt elements of the South African police still after you for your truth-telling. What was your state of mind back then? Certainly your primary concern was your wife and your family. You were also thinking about trying to rebuild your financial life. When did your thoughts then turn to whistleblower protection?
Well, in Greece, I tried to restart my life, you know, focusing and adapting to an unknown Greek mentality, much different to the one I had left 20 years ago as a teenager. Adapting to the Greek culture for myself and my wife was a challenge, especially in a country where things were working slow, the public sector was riddled with corruption, and we were entering a financial crisis in Europe. Unknowing to me at the time, I was suffering with PTSD, something that was diagnosed only in 2012 by Dr. Mary Reiners from Amnesty International, but interviewed me in Greece. But Greece was a blessing in disguise for us, and becoming a parent for the first time in a country with strong democratic values, relative safety, a society with respect of the law and order, as well as my successful investments in land and solar power, gave me a boost. Bottom line, I did not wish for future whistleblowers to go through what I had experienced and wanted to help improve a broken system, but often was responsible for causing more damage instead of helping whistleblowers. The assassination of Babita Deokaran in 2021 and my role through Blueprint for Free Speech as a coordinator for the African region, tasked me with engaging with the family members of late Babita Deokaran for presenting their daughter of hers with a posthumous award. And that touched my heart. I realized that within South Africa, a country notorious for killing its whistleblowers, the difference between life and death is the ability to have an escape plan. There were many more South African whistleblowers I dealt with, and many are still persecuted and in hiding. One of them is Patricia Masale.
You've worked alongside several different whistleblower organizations, and in the interest of transparency, you and I both worked with the outstanding Soulette Dreyfus of Blueprint for Free Speech. You then founded your own nonprofit called Liberty of Speech. Tell us what Liberty of Speech is working on and what issues are important to you.
Well, I focus in helping various organizations in promoting the freedom of expression of speech and improve whistleblower protection policies. Blueprint was my first collaboration and still going strong after 7 years. We have done a great deal of work with my close friend and mentor, Soulette Dreyfus. We do not like to advertise our work. Most of it happens behind closed doors. In 2018, I invited Soulette to entertain the idea of starting a Greek chapter of Blueprint in Greece and managed to start a Greek NGO named Blueprint for Greece. In 2023, we decided to broaden our activities and I started the NGO Liberty of Speech, with Dr. Soulette Dreyfus, who's been a member of the board. I wanted to extend our activities not only to defend Article 19 of Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but also Article 1 of United Nations for Human Rights. We had a lot of issues of trying to set this NGO, and in fact, we had a lot of attacks on the internet by radical elements in South Africa who tried to sabotage us and further characterize us. But we pulled through, and now we're trying to implement new policies that will help improve the safety of whistleblowers.
So one of the things that I know you're working on is the problem of slap suits and journalists. Tell us why this is so important and what relation it has to whistleblowing.
John, I always believe that the power to amplify the voices of whistleblowers lies with the journalist. The relationship between journalists and sources is sacred. When dealing with whistleblowers who wish to make an external public disclosure or anonymous tipping, journalists often become the subject of retaliation themselves. And strategic litigation against public participation is the order of the day, weaponizing the judiciary to silence professional organizations such as journalists, NGOs, social workers, attorneys, as well as whistleblowers themselves, is called slap suits. Now, in Greece, this is a common phenomenon, as you know, and often seen within civil and criminal charges against journalists simply because they are doing the job. I mean, how are journalists supposed to serve the public interest if they are in constant fear of retaliation? Especially in Greece, the judiciary process is painful, slow, and as we know, justice delayed is justice denied.
Ari, thank you for sharing your life story with us. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to go into some detail with Ari Denikas about the pace of whistleblower reforms, especially in Europe, and about where the most progress can be made in the shortest amount of time. Stay tuned.
Take a fresh look around at life. Kaleidoscopic, isn't it? A shattered reality distorted by power. Tired vision with no real opinions. Pictures designed to simplify or confuse. Who really wants a better world? And is it just for the chosen few? Fractured images presented as fact. Can you see through their illusions? Going underground can.
In your position, I was suggesting we bomb Belgrade. I was suggesting that we send American pilots in and blow up all the bridges on the Drina.
Branje bilo zasipano bombama, gdanima, ali ne ovakvim vrstom municije. Oni su taj relej rušili, umjesto klasičnim naoružanjem, rušili su uranijumom.
Koja opasnost nismo znali tačno?
Mi nismo ni znali da je gađano s osiromašenom uranijum.
It may be, you know, a lot less radioactive than something that's active uranium, but still it's radioactive and it has toxins in it that can kill you.
NATO i Amerikanci su izvršili genocid i ekocid nad ovim gradom i nad ovim ljudima ovde.
I was suggesting we bomb Belgrade.
To je bilo haos, stravota i užas.
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with Ari Denikas. He's the founder of the Greek whistleblower charity and NGO Liberty of Speech. Ari, thanks again for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Ari, you recently hosted an international conference in Greece that included not only prominent whistleblowers from around the continent, but that also addressed issues that had heretofore never even been discussed at whistleblower events in Greece. Tell us about that and about what progress was made there.
I was painfully initiated with our first conference that happened to be also international. And although against all odds, we had a low budget, we had the EU Parliament elections 3 days before our own conference, and a massive heat wave in Greece. But we managed to pull it through. I named it Global Corruption and Public Integrity, the Human Factor. We did it in collaboration with the Whistleblowers of America from your own country. And Jackie Garrick, the president and founder of this American NGO, traveled to Greece with a close friend and legal expert in human rights, Professor Joe Wade, in order to present some panels and help me pull this conference through. We also had the support of Blueprint for Free Speech, Transparency International Greece, Reported United, National Whistleblower Network with formidable Jane Turner, as well as many local organizations specialized in anti-corruption policies and accountability. Most importantly, we had the support of the Greek Justice Department, with the Secretary General as keynote speaker. Some of the topics were the Greek success or failure regarding the adaptation of the directive, as well as our alarming retaliation tools used against journalists, as we labeled it, the slap suits. We further had the support of GAP, UN, and Freedom House with Louis Portas, Tom Devine, and Samantha Camilletti speaking at the conference. We hosted a South African panel with prominent activists and whistleblowers discussing the topic of the human factor and what can South Africa do to help its whistleblowers.
That's fantastic, Ari. I'm very interested in legislation, as you know. Back in 2015, I worked with Blueprint for Free Speech to introduce a new whistleblower protection law in Greece. It didn't pass as we had written it, unfortunately, but a version of it did pass. More importantly, the European Union decided to adopt our original version as a model for the entire EU. It was one of the proudest events of my life. Tell us what the situation is in Greece right now. We still see, quite unfortunately, pushback from the parliament and especially from the conservative New Democracy government on whistleblower protections. Why is that? Why isn't this something on which everyone can agree?
Oh, this is a sensitive and complex issue, John. Greece is facing many demons, both political, ethical, judicial, and cultural. I mean, the government's priority is in producing higher volumes of investments and advertising a recovered economy, well, at least on paper. But corruption and tax evasion, in conjunction with an alarming rising in living expenses, as well as high taxation, makes the Greek people very unhappy. The fact of the matter is that the public sector is one of the largest in Europe for its country size, and in my opinion, one of the most corrupted and not efficient in Europe. You know, while its purpose is to secure votes to every government that will favor them just before the elections, I'm talking about the public sector as we know it. Now, you have all generations of businessmen that are reluctant to promote anti-corruption policies because most of them thrived professionally within a country that its economy supported corruption in the past. But the new generation of business minds are educated and adopting a universal EU culture against corruption, as well as promoting sustainability models that support transparency through government accountability and the whistleblowing concept. Regarding culture, there is no political consistency. Greek governments come and go, letting the public down, entering in and out of financial crises, introducing higher taxes each year, expensive cost of livings, while sustaining a corrupted and dysfunctional public sector. And as a result, many Greeks will promote tax evasions themselves, as well as corruption when it comes to increasing profits of their own or their own business in order to survive. It is a cat and mouse game. Now, judiciary. Greece took over a year after the EU deadlines to implement into its national laws the 2019 EU Directive for the Whistleblower Protection Act. It was a sloppy house job that adopted absolutely minimum standards, while the EU encourages member states to extend the directive to a broader scope regarding corruption and public disclosure at the place of work. In essence, the EU asked them to do more, but the Greek did less. To be fair, there are moderate efforts currently to reform the Whistleblower Protection Act in Greece, and I'm briefed about it by the officials responsible for it, but I hold a small basket, since the decision lies with the interest of politicians themselves. We need more active public participation in this matter, including the NGOs. One of the problems lies with old-fashioned politicians and conservative lawmakers who are stuck in the old ways. We need younger brains.
In your experience, what is the state of whistleblower protection elsewhere in Europe? We hear horror stories, especially from the banking sector whistleblowers, and especially in places like Switzerland and France. And what of South Africa? Have there been any improvements there?
So I think that the whistleblower concept is confusing in most EU countries. The issue here is how much transparency and how little corruption we desire, as well as how serious the EU is in eliminating corruption cross-border. There are many state members with a conflict of interest in national laws, political obstacles, cultural and language barriers. The banking sector is a state within a state, so currently it is a lost game when it comes to holding them accountable for corruption within the banking sector. Switzerland is not in the EU, but France has no excuse in imposing tough EU legislation to its banking sector. South Africa is at its lowest point at the moment. When it comes to accountability, corruption index, and whistleblowing protection policies, although there is a positive attitude within the public culture to promote public disclosures and whistleblower protection policies, this is only theory, and practically there is no effective mechanism to protect whistleblowers and their families. As I have mentioned many times, South Africa is notorious for killing its whistleblowers.
Ari, you recently released an idea for an international whistleblower treaty. A United Nations official called it music to her ears. Tell us about that and about its current status.
So the idea came from my own whistleblower experience in South Africa, the way I escaped what I believed was certain death, and my engagement later on with South African whistleblowers and the stories. When I realized that there are countries so corrupted that often the whistleblowers are getting assassinated, persecuted, or silenced, I remembered how privileged I was to hold dual citizenship and two passports and escape to a friendly country after my public disclosures. That escape plan made the difference between life and death, but other whistleblowers in South Africa did not have this option and paid with their lives. Thus, the idea of the International Treaty for Whistleblowers, as well as the issuing of an expedited visa for whistleblowers in distress, came to me. It is published on our website as well as the Blueprints website. In 2023, I was invited by Jackie Garrick, the president of Whistleblowers for America, in your country, in the USA, to travel and present my paper on this idea to the United States. In fact, we engaged with congressional staffers at the Capitol, and we also engaged further together. I think Joe and I, we also had a discussion at the Whistleblower for America Conference Workplace Promise Institute in 2023. At my latest conference hosted on the 11th and 12th June in Greece, I had the privilege to close the conference with the introduction of my paper, and a UN senior officer, Luis Portas, was on the panel and commented that it was music in his ears. I have his support on this and will engage with key players globally to promote as well as refine the idea. Hopefully, it will be my legacy. In fact, in a few days, I am honored by the University of Johannesburg in South Africa to present my paper of the International Treaty for Whistleblowers at the academic conference held on the 18th of July, titled Breaking the Chain of Corruption, Whistleblowers as Catalyst for Social Development in South Africa.
You're not afraid of anybody, are you? No, neither am I. That's right. Ari Dinikas, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The basic reason for whistleblowing is really quite simple. It's to expose non-transparent and wrongful acts by those in power in order to enable reform. It's to shine a light into dark places to expose waste, fraud, abuse, or illegality. Whistleblowers, therefore, must be appreciated. They must be protected and thanked for their courage and public service. That's usually not how it works out, though. The road is much tougher than that. I'd like to thank our guest, Ari Dinikas, for being with us today, and thank you to our viewers for joining us for another episode of The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. Please follow me on Substack, at John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.